rash, but it's better than nothing.
Earl, I want you to listen.
She held out her hand, which felt cool to his touch.
Some people give up when they come to a place like this, she said. I see it in their faces. They just run out of fight. And the weaker you get, believe me, it's tempting. The painkillers they've got nowadays, goodness. The days and weeks slide by my window like a big, warm river. But don't worry. I'm not ready to call it quits just yet.
You can't, Toole blurted. He felt mad, although he wasn't sure why. When's the last time you seen your daughters?
It's hard for them to get away. The children are in school.
That's a bullshit excuse.
Maureen laughed softly.
I'd slap you, Earl, if I had the strength.
He was at a loss.
You won't? I'll try and give you a bath.
You'll do no such thing.
She pinched his wrist.
Good Lord, I shouldn't have said a word.
Toole's mother had passed away barely a month after the doctors had told her she was sick. It was in the middle of a tomato harvest, and he didn't get back to Jacksonville in time to say goodbye. He heard himself telling the whole story to Maureen, who said,
Don't feel bad. I'm sure she knew how much you loved her.
Your daughters ought to be here. It ain't that far away.
He pressed the call button so hard that it broke apart in his fist.
Shit, he said. I'm sorry.
Earl, you need to calm down. I've got no intention of dying today.
At last a nurse came in with a fresh IV bag, two small vials of narcotics, and a diaper for grown-ups. Toole stepped away from the bed to give Maureen some privacy. The nurse was a muscular, pitch-black woman who spoke quietly to Maureen in an accent that Toole recognized as Jamaican. He thought about all the pickers from Jamaica that he'd yelled at and slapped around and ripped off, and he felt sort of shitty and low. The nurse who was helping Maureen might have been one of their sisters or cousins or even a daughter. Her smile was as bright as a sunrise, and when she touched a hand to Maureen's forehead, Toole knew right then and there that he was done with crew bossing forever. He'd never be able to look at one of them sweaty black boys in the eye and not think about this moment, about how jumbled and sour he felt toward himself. Somewhere in life he'd taken a wrong-headed turn, and most likely it was too late to back up. For sure he'd gotten in awful deep with Red Hammernut, who now wanted him to do something that would send him even further down the highway to hell. A week ago, Toole would have said yes to any fool job, no matter how bad, as long as it paid in cash. But then he'd met Maureen.
She gonna be okay?
He asked the Jamaican nurse.
Or she'll feel better after breakfast.
Maureen said, Earl, this is Evie. She's one of the good ones. The nurse laughed.
I'll come back in an hour for your bath.
As soon as they were alone again, Maureen said,
She's a sharp girl. You should let her take a look at that problem with your you-know-what.
No thanks.
Toole wasn't spreading his ass crack to any female stranger, black, white, or purple polka-dotted.
For heaven's sake, Earl, she's a professional health care provider.
How about some TV?
Mm-hmm, said Maureen.
Toole noticed that her breathing had slowed, and her eyelids were droopy. The drugs that Nurse Evie had brought, combined with the second-hand fentanyl patch, were taking effect. Maybe now Maureen could grab a decent sleep. He said,
I better go.
Thank you for the company, Earl.
Anytime.
I didn't even think to ask about your bodyguarding, she said drowsily. How's it going with that big-shot doctor?
Same old crap.
When Toole started to leave, Maureen turned her face to the wall and curled herself into a shape that reminded him of a question mark.
Don't you dare give up, he said anxiously.
Not me.
I'm dead serious now.
Earl?
He could barely hear her speak, so he leaned over the bed rail and balanced his huge head close to hers.
Yes, ma'am. What is it?
Earl, I need a favor.
Anything.
It's a whopper,
Maureen said.
Just name it.
Can you get me out of here?
Tool smiled. I thought you'd never ask.
Chaz Perone awoke nude in his yellow Humvee on the shoulder of Interstate 95 somewhere in Palm Beach County. Friday morning, rush hour. His bladder was the size of Lake Okeechobee, and his skull was splitting open like a rotten melon. He opened the passenger door and tried to take a leak, but it felt as if he were pissing broken glass. Crawling behind the steering wheel, he was relieved to spy the keys in the ignition. He headed home with careful regard for the speed limits, not wishing to be stopped by the cops and forced to explain his appearance. He was grateful for the absurd height of the Hummer, which concealed his chafed and sallow nakedness from other motorists, save for a few coarse truck drivers.
What the hell happened last night? Chaz wondered, squinting into the cruel morning sun.
The last thing he remembered with clarity was Rose and those incredible short jeans leading him to her bedroom. That's when he must have flipped out, because somehow Rose had morphed into Joey, and right away she'd started unloading an unholy ration of shit. Joey in the same skirt and blouse that she'd been wearing on the night he threw her overboard. By the time Chaz reached the exit for West Boca Dunes Phase 2, he had it all figured out. What had triggered his freakout was watching the video of Joey's murder over and over, that combined with too much booze. And hadn't Rose been wearing the same perfume as Joey? Chaz didn't recall running from the bedroom, but apparently that's what he'd done. Dashed out the front door, dove into the Hummer, and took off. Rose must have thought he was totally whacked. He glanced down at his pecker, which he scarcely recognized in its dolorous, chastened droop. He wondered if he'd ever again be able to initiate a sex act without being taunted by the ambrosial ghost of his dead wife. He wheeled into his driveway and parked next to Tool's Grand Marquis, checking both ways down the street before loping into the house. The door to the big goon's room was shut, so Chaz furtively padded to the kitchen, where he gulped four aspirins with a chaser of Mountain Dew. Then he stepped into the shower and propped himself against the tiles, massaging his hangover until the hot water ran out. When he emerged from the bathroom, the phone was ringing.
"Where you been, son?"
It was Red Hammernut.
"I left like a dozen goddamn messages on your answer machine."
"I spent the night at a friend's," Chaz said.
"Without Mr. O'Toole?"
"It was an emergency, Red."
"You want to talk about emergencies? Tell you what, I got a major league motherfucker of an emergency arrived just yesterday by Federal Express. It's a video cassette."
"Oh, shit."
"Up to your eyeballs, son. You know about this damn thing."
"Yes, sir. I got one, too."
"Is that so?"
Red Hammernut sounded like he was working up to a spit.
"I thought I seen plenty in my day, Chaz, but never nothing like this. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't shook up."
Red's slurred delivery suggested that he'd gotten an early start on his cocktails.
"Let's not do this on the phone," he said to Chaz.
"You want me to drive over to the office?"
"Hell no! I'm parked right in front of your goddamn house."
Chaz went to the window and saw the gray Cadillac idling in the swale. He stepped into a wrinkled pair of trousers and hurried outside. The passenger door of the big car swung open and Chaz climbed into the chill. Red Hammernut was dressed just like he'd stepped off a marlin boat, a sunburned gnome and Eddie Bauer khakis. He had a plug of tobacco in one cheek and a smear of zinc oxide on his radish-shaped nose. From his thick, ruddy neck hung a pair of polarized sunglasses. A bottle of Jack Daniels stood open on the seat back tray. No glass. Chaz said,
"I didn't know the guy had a video camera. When I saw the tape, I was blown away." "Son, it's bad, bad news."
"The worst," Chad agreed.
"I gotta say, it was a terrible thing to watch. I always liked Joey. I really did," Red said. "I won't ask why you done it, because it ain't none of my business."
Chaz was mildly irritated.
"But we talked about it, remember? How worried I was? I thought she'd figured out our whole deal."
He was disappointed that Red hadn't commented on the efficiency of the crime itself, the steel balls it took to go through with it.
We've got to pay the blackmail, Red. Now there's no choice.
I agree.
The whole 500, right?
Yep,
Red Hammernut said.
The full load.
Chaz Perone's relief almost instantly gave way to suspicion. He'd been expecting resistance, or at the least some loony alternate plan. He knew how much Red cherished his money. Dropping $500,000 was enough to send him on a 6-month bender.
The drop is set for tonight, Chaz said, on a house somewhere in the middle of Biscayne Bay. The guy wrote down a GPS heading.
Yeah, Tool told me.
You talked to Tool?
That's right. I already gave him the cash to hold.
Red Hammernut took a pull from the bottle of bourbon.
Why you look so surprised, son? The man works for me.
Yeah, so do I, Chaz reminded him.
And you're in charge of buying the suitcase.
Red said this with no trace of sarcasm.
I got you boys a boat for the night, a 23-footer at Bayside Marina. That's downtown Miami, across from the basketball arena. Tool's good with outboards. You let him drive.
Whatever, said Chaz.
He was thinking about the scene toward the end of Goodfellas, when everything's falling apart for the gangsters, and the Ray Liotta character meets the Robert De Niro character at a diner. The two of them are sitting there calmly talking about all the problems and all the heat, just like Red and I are talking, Chaz thought, when the De Niro character nonchalantly asks the Ray Liotta character to go down to Florida and do a job. And right then, at that instant, the Ray Liotta character knows he's being set up for a hit.
Son, I don't want no funny business out there in the water,
Red Hammernut was saying.
I told Tool the same thing. Pay the sumbitch and get the hell out of Dodge.
You hear? Just like in the movie, Chaz thought. Once I was the partner, and now I'm the problem. He understood that Red Hammernut was looking at the big picture. The blackmailer posed a threat to Red only as long as Chaz was alive. The Hummer was the most traceable connection between them, and Red could always blame that on Chaz. He could say the biologist had hit him up for a new set of wheels. As a matter of fact, Red could say the whole Everglades scam, faking the pollution charts, had been Chaz's idea. A shakedown from the beginning. Once Chaz was gone, who could dispute it?
I want you guys to get it over with. That's the main thing, Red Hammernut was saying. Be done with it for good.
Amen, thought Chaz. The time has come. 29. Joey and her brother carried the dinner scraps down to the seawall to feed the fish. Stranahan sat at the picnic table cleaning his rifle. He was relieved to be home, distant from the lunacy of the mainland. Strom lay at his feet and refused to move, even for a flock of rowdy gulls. All afternoon the dog had stayed near his side, sensing that something was in the works. If only humans were that intuitive, Stranahan thought. With Strom at his heels, he carried the Ruger to the boat. Joey watched him wrap the gun in an oilcloth and stow it in the bow hatch.
Mick, get this, she said. My brother has the hots for my husband's girlfriend.
Corbett Wheeler waved an objection.
Hold on. All I said was she didn't seem like a bimbo.
That's what happens when you live with cloven beasts. Your standards take a dive, Joey said. My advice is not to date anybody you meet at a funeral. Ask Chaz if you don't believe me. Stranahan sat down beside her on the seawall, the Doberman nosing between them. Joey clasped Stranahan's hand, the sort of knuckle-busting squeeze that takes place at 35,000 feet during heavy turbulence. She was nervous about the blackmail meeting, as any sane person would be. Corbett asked, "What are the odds of actually collecting the dough?" "Not too good," Stranahan conceded. He anticipated that Samuel Johnson Hammernut would provide all or part of the 500 grand as bait. Chaz's Neanderthal babysitter would guard the stash until they arrived at the drop site, where he'd open the suitcase and encourage Stranahan to count the bills. At the first opportunity, he would then try to kill Stranahan. Later, probably on the boat trip back to the mainland, he'd do the same to Chaz Perone. There were a dozen unappealing variations of that scenario, and Stranahan had fretted through all of them. Initially, he'd planned to make the pickup alone, but Joey and Corbett were adamant about joining him. Stranahan understood. For them, it was personal. He also appreciated the tactical advantage in numbers. Hammernut's hired gorilla surely would realize that he couldn't take all three of them by surprise, and Stranahan was gambling that he wouldn't try. The man was more brute than sharpshooter. Joey said, "If they do give up the money, we're donating it to one of the Everglades foundations." "Anonymously, I presume," said her brother. Stranahan felt like pouring a stiff drink, but that was out of the question. There was a better than even chance he'd have to shoot somebody later. Corbett Wheeler said, "I like your island very much, Mick, but it's a bit too near the city lights for me." "Shh. I'm trying to persuade your little sister it's paradise." "Little sister is already persuaded," Joey said, wiggling her toes in the water. Corbett made a wistful pitch for New Zealand. "Once you come, you'll never want to leave." "If tonight goes badly, we might be visiting soon," Stranahan said, "depending on the extradition policy." Joey jabbed him in the ribs. "Stop. Think positive thoughts." To the west, a palisade of violet clouds obscured the setting sun. The breeze died in wisps, and the bay slicked off. Stranahan hurried to the boathouse and got out three suits of yellow foul weather gear. Strom's ears pricked at the faraway roll of thunder. "Never a dull moment," said Corbett. Joey said, "The good news is Chaz can't stand the rain." Stranahan was more interested in the lightning. He could think of safer places to be than in an open skiff on a large body of water during an electrical storm. The sensible move was to call off the drop, but it was too late. "Let's go," he said, "before the wind kicks up." Chaz Perone locked himself in the bathroom with a stack of smutty magazines and the framed photograph of Joey that he'd lifted from the altar of St. Conan's after the service. His habitual remedy for anxiety was to wank at himself with simian zest, but even the youthful picture of his late wife, centered beatifically amid the cheap porn, triggered only a transient tumescence. His fevered and doleful manipulations were interrupted by a heavy rap on the door.
"Where's that fucking gun?" Toole demanded.
"I got rid of it," Chaz lied, hastily tucking himself into his boxers.
"Let me in."
"I'm on the can."
"No, you ain't."
Toole kicked the door open and stared with overt disgust at the photos spread across the bathroom floor.
"God almighty," he said.
Chaz snatched up the picture of Joey and wedged it under one arm. Then he dropped to his knees and started scooping up the magazine, saying, "You don't understand. I'm a nervous wreck. I had to do something." Toole regarded him as if he were some sort of schoolyard flasher.
"The gun, boy,"
Chaz said. "I told you, I threw it away."
"Red said no funny business out on the water."
"I heard him."
"You done hear?"
Toole motioned snidely at the toilet.
"'Cause it's time we should go."
"Let me get dressed. I'll meet you outside," said Chaz. The blue-plated .38 was hidden at the bottom of the laundry hamper. He slipped it with his cell phone into a zippered pocket of a Patagonia rain jacket, which he folded neatly and carried to the Hummer. Toole was enthroned behind the steering wheel, chewing a stick of beef jerky and tapping his stained fingers to a country song. Chaz said,
"What are you doing?"
"What's it look like?"
"You are not driving my truck."
"Red said so. Hop in, Doc."
Chaz was steamed. "What about the suitcase?" He'd purchased a gray, hard-shell Samsonite with retractable wheels. Toole had packed the cash by himself, stack after stack of $100 bills. Although he'd refused to let Chaz anywhere near the money, the mere sight of it had been intoxicating. Toole motioned with his thumb.
"It's in the back."
Chaz climbed in on the passenger side. To remind Toole who owned the vehicle, he reached for the tuner knob on the stereo. Toole caught his hand and slammed it against the top of the dashboard. Chaz's arm went numb.
"That's Patsy Cline," Toole said simply.
"Christ! I think you broke my wrist!"
"Don't ever mess with the radio when Patsy Cline is on."
"Goddamn psycho," Chaz thought.
He couldn't feel any fractures, but something in his left hand was either sprained, torn, or jammed. Tool maintained a surly silence during the ride to Miami, though he turned out to be a decent driver. Chaz was holding himself together pretty well until he heard the first boom of thunder and eyeballed the blackening line of clouds ahead of them. "What if they won't rent us the boat in this weather?" he asked. Tool seemed entertained by the question.
"Don't you worry. Red's got it all took care of."
Chaz opened the envelope and read over the blackmailer's instructions again. "You sure you know how to use a GPS?" he asked. Tool said it was easy.
"One season I had some trouble over at Immokalee, so I went down to Ramrod Key and run a crayfish boat for a fella. He had an import business on the side, so we spent some time in the islands, off the books. Made the crossing back and forth from Cay Sal in all kinds of storms."
"Worse than this?" Chaz said.
"On occasion, you bet."
The rain was sheeting by the time they parked at the bayside marina and found the boat. It was a 23-foot outboard with a bimini top and a big four-stroke Yamaha. A Garmin GPS had been mounted on the console. Tool set the heavy suitcase in the stern. Chaz bundled unhappily into his foul weather gear, the hammer of the pistol poking his ribs. He pulled up his hood and peered at the leaking leaden sky. His left wrist throbbed painfully. Tool found a portable spotlight and plugged it into a battery jack. He seemed surprised that the device actually worked. Tool started the engine and cast off the ropes and motored slowly away from the docks. When they reached the open water, he told Chaz to sit his ass down, and he threw the throttle forward. Simultaneously, there was a clap of thunder that made Chaz duck.
"This is insane," he told himself.
What he had planned for tonight would have been difficult in clear, calm conditions. In a squall, it could be suicide. He hunkered low, cringing at every glint of lightning. Tool seemed at ease, one hand on the wheel, the other working the spotlight, though his overalls were soaked and sagging. The rain had slicked down the dense black curls on his arms and shoulders, giving him a surreal, lustrous sheen in the twilight. Soon they passed beneath the Rickenbacker Causeway Bridge, which Chaz had crossed often as a grad student on his way to the Rosenstiel School. The sight reminded him of his long-ago ordeal with sea lice, and he speculated that the hungry little bastards were floating all around them in avid anticipation should Tool manage to capsize the boat. Also looming in Chaz's imagination was the larger, more lethal menace of sharks. Such attacks were virtually unheard of on Biscayne Bay, one of the many facts that Chaz had either forgotten or simply failed to register during his idle schooling in the marine sciences. The ravenous two-headed alligator starring in Chaz's recent nightmares could just as easily have been a hammerhead, given his visceral dread and lazy ignorance of both species. Blessedly, the thunder quieted, and the downpour faded to a drizzle, although they hit a chilly wall of wind which buffeted them most of the way to Cape Florida. The ride was more than sufficient to reinforce Chaz's loathing of the great outdoors. Clinging with his uninjured hand to the bench seat, he envisioned himself hurled to the deck with such force that the pistol in his jacket would discharge accidentally. If the shot didn't kill him outright, the noise would probably give him a heart attack. Navigating with the magic of global satellites, Tool located what was left of Stiltsville, an old community of wooden houses constructed on pilings in the shallow grass beds. Hurricane Andrew had practically leveled the place, and the few remaining structures had been taken over by the National Park Service. The empty, unlit homes looked skeletal beneath the hot blue flickers of lightning. Tool turned off the engine and let the boat ride the outgoing tide down the channel. He muttered under his breath, his scowl visible in the green glow of the GPS screen.
"What's wrong?" Chaz asked.
"This is right where he told us to meet him," Tool said, "but I don't like it."
As they came abreast of the last stilt house, Tool lumbered to the bow and heaved out an anchor. The rope went taut, and the boat stopped dead, the bow dipping slightly under Tool's bulk. He made his way back to the console and sat down with a grimace.
"Now we wait," he said, rubbing his buttocks.
Chaz checked his watch. It was more than an hour until the meeting. He turned on his cell phone as the blackmailer had instructed. From the mainland came another rumble, and high in the clouds a jagged burst of bright light.
"That bunch is still a ways off," Tool said. "If A-hole is on time, we'll be long gone before it hits."
At least one of us will, Chaz thought. He was sure that Red Hammernut had ordered Tool to kill him and make it look like a suicide. The grief-stricken widower, unable to cope with the loss of his wife, decides to join her at sea for eternity. But Chaz Perone had 13 million reasons to stay alive, and a plan of his own.
"Where's the damn ice chest?" Tool asked. "I'm thirsty."
"Guess I left it in the Hummer."
"Tell me you ain't serious."
"Sorry." With his good hand, Chaz took the Colt from his jacket and pointed it at Tool's massive silhouette. Tool didn't notice the gun until it was illuminated by a flash from the oncoming storm. Chaz couldn't make out the goon's expression, but he plainly heard the warning.
"I wouldn't do that, boy."
"Sure you would," Chaz said, and squeezed the trigger twice. The first shot punched a hole in the canvas bimini top. The second knocked Tool overboard, causing a splash that was more of a concussion, like a meat freezer being dropped into a swimming pool. Chaz emptied the .38 into the foamy crater and watched to see if the body would float up right away, like they did on TV cop shows. He'd expected Tool's wintry coat of hair to provide extra buoyancy, yet there was no sign of the dead man bobbing to the surface. As Chaz pocketed the revolver, his cell phone rang.
"What the hell's going on?"
The blackmailer sounded serious and alarmed. No Jerry Lewis impressions tonight.
"I was shooting at turtles," Chaz said. "Where are you?"
Chaz had thought he'd have plenty of time, but the guy was early. He'd heard the gunshots, and now he was spooked.
"Turtles?" he said.
Chaz laughed casually.
"I was bored. Are you close by? Let's get this done before that damn thunderstorm gets here."
"Where's the ape man?"
"Oh, he couldn't make it."
The blackmailer hung up.
"Shit," Chaz said.
He groped around the deck until he found the spotlight. He swept the beam slowly back and forth across the water. No other vessel was in sight. Moments later, the phone rang again.
"Where are you?"
Chaz demanded.
"Up here,"
said a different voice. A woman's voice. One that made him stiffen.
"Get rid of the gun," she said. "Over the side."
Chaz worked the spotlight up and down the stilt cottage. Sitting on the edge of the roof was none other than his wife. Very much alive. She appeared to be aiming a large caliber rifle at his head.
"Joey? Is that really you?"
Chaz whispered into the phone.
The muzzle of the rifle flared orange, and the windshield of the boat exploded before Chaz's terrified eyes. "Does that answer your question?" she shouted.
Obediently, he took the .38 from his jacket and threw it into the bay. The first gunshots had caught Mick Stranahan by surprise. "I believe Numbnuts just killed his babysitter," he informed Joey Perone and Corbett Wheeler. The three of them were flattened against the roof, invisible to Chaz from the boat.
"Now what?"
Joey whispered.
"I honestly don't know.
Let me see the rifle," she said.
Stranahan glanced at Corbett, who nodded sympathetically.
"She needs to get this out of her system."
"Easy," Stranahan said when she took the Ruger. He had allowed her to try it once before, blasting coconuts out of palm trees on the island. It had a powerful kick, but Joey had handled it capably. Stranahan phoned Chaz Perone on his cellular to find out what had happened on the boat. After a short exchange, he hung up.
"That's it," he said. "He's flying solo."
Joey groaned.
"What a schmuck."
"If he's killed the bodyguard, then he might be planning to kill Hammernut, too," Stranahan surmised.
"And the girlfriend," Corbett added quietly. "Rika."
"It's all right to say her name," Joey said.
"Now, what about us, Mick?"
"Once Chaz sees the Ruger, he'll probably fold. Right now, he thinks he's Vin Diesel."
Stranahan dialed Chaz's cell number and handed her the phone.
"Tell him to toss the gun or the deal's off," he said. "Where are you?"
Chaz was demanding on the other end.
"Up here," Joey answered.
Corbett and Mick climbed down from the roof and sneaked beneath the house where the whaler was tied. Stranahan's idea was that the two of them would swim quietly out to the boat and overpower Chaz. They were peeling out of their clothes when the rifle went off, and they heard Joey shout,
"Does that answer your question?"
"Don't shoot!"
her husband screamed back.
"Give me 10 good reasons why not."
That a girl, thought Stranahan. Corbett tugged his arm.
Mick, I heard something else.
Where?
Close by, listen.
Stranahan heard it too.
I'll be damned.
Game over, he thought with a rush of relief. Thanks to Chaz Perone's fabulous inefficiency as a killer, they were now free to do what Darwin would have done, back off and let nature take over. Left to his own greedy wits, Joey's husband had no chance whatsoever.
There it is again, Corbett whispered intently.
Stranahan nodded. Music to my ears.
A gust of wind caused the old stilt house to creak and murmur above them. The clouds lit up, and through the piling Stranahan could make out the shape of the boat in the channel and the figure of Charles Perone holding the spotlight in the bow.
Hurry!
Stranahan crept down the catwalk toward the source of the moans, a floundering gray mass that in the shallows might easily have been mistaken for a stricken manatee.
But what about Joey? Corbett asked.
Hell, let her have some fun, Stranahan said. Come on, help me get this poor bastard out of the water.
Joey scooted off the roof and reappeared at the end of the dock, barely 100 feet from where the boat was anchored. She wore an oversized yellow rain suit with the hood down, her blonde ponytail whipping in the wind. Chaz struggled to steady the spotlight, but the boat was rocking and his hand shook, a condition aggravated by the sight of his wife with a loaded rifle.
So, last night was real, he thought numbly.
What's the matter, darling?
Joey shouted acidly. He raised his palms in a gesture of defeat.
What? You can't figure it out, she said. It's simple. You pushed me off the ship, only I didn't drown.
How is that possible?
It's called swimming, Chaz. Where's the money?
He motioned behind him, where the Samsonite lay flat against the transom. From the dock, Joey couldn't see it. The wind was rising, and Chaz didn't hear her speak again until there was a lull between the gusts. She yelled,
I'm waiting for the 10 reasons why I shouldn't blow your head off.
What?
A raindrop splatted on Chaz's nose, and morosely he cast his gaze downward. The black dress hanging in the closet, the cut-up photograph hidden beneath his pillow, the fact that the Coast Guard had found nothing but her fingernails. Of course Joey was alive. It all added up.
Chaz! Just a second! I'm trying to think, he shouted back.
The barrel of the rifle flashed again, and the spotlight shattered in Chaz's fist. Shards of glass and plastic tinkled to the deck.
Okay, I've got it, he cried frantically. I'm mentally disturbed.
What?
Reason number one why you shouldn't shoot me. I'm sick in the head. Honey, I need help.
That's the best you can do? Joey asked.
Unfortunately, it was. Chaz Perone couldn't come up with a single good reason why his wife shouldn't blast his brains out. Desperately, he sought to change the subject.
Where have you been for the last 2 weeks?
Watching you make a clown of yourself.
Joey,
hiding under our bed while you tried to screw a size 10 with a rose tattooed on her ankle. It was pitiful.
Chaz felt gutted by humiliation. Medea, he recalled abjectly, the humming reflexologist. It made him shrivel to think that Joey had been eavesdropping during one of his sexual malfunctions. He tried to turn the tables by slinging guilt.
You put us all through hell. We had a church service and everything.
I'm touched, Joey called out. Start packing for prison because I'm going to the cops. And I'm taking the videotape.
Honey, please.
There's no golfing in prison, Chaz. No slutty hairdressers either.
The rain slapping down on the waves sounded to Charles Perone like cruel applause.
What about that will?
He heard his voice quaver. Was it real or not?
Apparently you are sick in the head, his wife said.
So that's that, Chaz thought bleakly. No $13 million after all. The wind dropped suddenly to a cool sigh, the proverbial calm before the storm.
I don't understand a damn thing anymore, Chaz spluttered. Where's the guy who set up this meeting? The son of a bitch who dragged me out in that canoe with all those damn mosquitoes. Oh, he's right here, Chaz, waiting for you to try something foolish.
Then you're in on this too?
Joey let out a hoot.
From day one, darling.
But why? You don't need the fucking money.
It's not about the money, she said. How can you be such a bonehead?
A fair question, Chaz had to admit. He'd been wrong about almost everything, starting with the direction of the Gulf Stream, and wrong about almost everyone from Rolvag to Red Hammernut to Rika. The reappearance of his once-dead wife left Chaz hopelessly stewed in confusion. The only thing that seemed real was the suitcase containing $500,000. Chaz couldn't help thinking about where it could take him and how long he could make it last.
You threw my stuff away, Joey was saying. All my clothes and my pictures and my books, even my orchid.
Not everything. Your jewelry's in a safe box at the bank, Chaz said. I'll give you the key if you want.
Asshole!
What if I said I was sorry, because I really am, Chaz pleaded across the water. I messed up big time, Joey. Nothing's the same since you've been gone. Wasn't that the whole point?
A lightning bolt struck one of the other stilt houses, the thunderclap so deafening that Chaz shielded his head. When he got the nerve to look up, he saw through a fresh sheet of rain that his wife had been joined on the dock by the blackmailer, who was shirtless. The man had one arm around Joey's waist, and he was whispering in her ear.
"Don't worry! I've got your money!" Chaz hollered anxiously. "Keep it!" the man called back.
"What?"
"You keep it, Chazzy!"
Joey waved a mocking farewell.
"You heard him! Now get out of here before I change my mind!"
Chaz hurriedly hauled up the anchor. When Joey appeared to raise the rifle to her shoulder, he sensibly dove behind the console. The gunshot coincided with a boom of thunder, the bullet whining harmlessly above the stern. Chaz held his breath, but not his bladder, shivering at the sudden flood of warmth down his legs.
"Aren't you even going to say goodbye?" Joey shouted.
A final burst of shots followed, all high. The tide and a tailwind carried the boat steadily away, the bow spinning in the surface currents. The rain began to sting, and the lightning strobed, and the air crackled like fire. Chaz stayed low, strangely comforted by the knocking of the waves against the hull. He couldn't understand why Joey and the blackmailer had let him go, nor could he shake the vision of the two of them standing on the dock. They'd look shockingly comfortable together, more like a couple than business partners, and Chaz wondered jealously if it was possible that his wife was now sleeping with a shakedown artist. The farther the boat floated from the stilt house, the less Chaz Perone worried about gunfire. When he finally found the courage to grab for the ignition, he managed to break off the key inside the switch. Not knowing how to hand crank an outboard motor, Chaz abandoned his fantasy of a high-speed escape. By now, there was more than an inch of water on deck, and no evidence of a functioning bilge pump. He crabbed to the stern and clammed onto the Samsonite, in case the boat began to sink. He was banking that the suitcase would float, cash and all. 2 hours later, he was wheeling it down the Cape Florida beach, calling on his cell phone for a taxi.
"Mick, I swear to God, I'm proud of you for not shooting him." Stranahan lifted the Ruger from her hands. She said, "I couldn't do it, and don't ask why."
"As long as it's not because you still love him, then I'll have to go drown myself."
"Love? The man is sewer scum," Joey said bitterly. "But I kept remembering what you told me about how it feels to kill somebody, about all the nightmares that come later."
"It's a good way to end up living alone on an island." "You did the right thing," Stranahan told her. "If I was a better shot, I would have winged him at least. You get big points for hitting the spotlight. Here, I want you to meet somebody." Earl Edward O'Toole sat upright, a glistening lump propped against a rusty propane tank at the far end of the dock. Corbett Wheeler knelt beside him.
"Mr. O'Toole has a bullet slug embedded in his right armpit," he reported, "and he refuses medical attention."
Toole's sopping overalls were frayed, and his hairy arms were bloodied from hugging the barnacle-encrusted piling. That's where Corbett and Mick had found him, groaning and barely afloat under the stilt house. It had taken all their might to muscle him out of the water. He blinked up at Joey.
"I know you."
"Anastasia from Flamingo," she said, bowing. "Nice to see you again."
"But in real life, you're the dead girl, right?"
"That's me, the dead girl."
"But I don't get it," Tool said. "Red said there was video of the whole thing."
Corbett cut in. "There is indeed. We made it ourselves. Mick put on a brown wig and played the homicidal husband, Joey played herself, and I held the camera." The tricky part had been staging his sister's tumble over the rail. They had chosen the deck where the lifeboats were hung so she'd have a safe place to land. Tool looked amused.
"What the hell's this all about?"
"A touchy marital situation," Stranahan said. Joey sighed impatiently. "That's enough. The man needs a doctor." Tool winced as he rearranged his bulk.
"Lady, your husband is a card-carrying shitwad."
"Thanks for the bulletin."
"Where's the suitcase?"
"In the boat," Joey said, "with Chaz."
"And where's he at?"
Stranahan pointed toward the mountain of weather that was sliding out of the bay toward the Atlantic.
"He took the money. Red's money," Tool said thoughtfully.
"That's our boy." Corbett tried to examine the bullet wound, but Tool knocked his hand away. "Why did he shoot you?" Joey asked.
"Guess 'cause he figured I was gonna shoot him first."
"Were you?"
"Sure. But then I changed my mind. That's what gets me," Tool said sourly. "Here I go and do the decent Christian thing, which is to let the man off the hook. And what happens? He plugs me."
Stranahan was putting on his clothes and rain suit. Corbett showed him the 9mm Beretta that he'd taken from the pocket of Tool's overalls. Stranahan emptied the chamber, popped out the clip, and handed the empty gun to Tool, who flung it off the dock.
"Thing's waterlogged," he said. "Hey, you see him out there anywheres?"
Joey shook her hand. Her fists were on her hips as she stared hard into the opaque gloom. The lightning had temporarily stopped, making it impossible to spot a small boat in the distance. She said, "Mick, you'd better be right about this."
"Stop worrying. He's history."
Tool labored to his feet.
"You take me back to dry land, we'll call it even for what happened at the docks house. You slugging me in the damn throat and all."
"It's the least I can do," Stranahan agreed. He and Corbett helped Earl Edward O'Toole get in the skiff, which heeled precariously under the load. Joey was hesitant to join them, but there was no other way out of Stiltsville. Corbett handed out the life jackets. Tool couldn't fit into his.
"I gotta lay off them Pringles," he said.
Even in the night shadows, Joey could see a thin, dark stream running from under his arm. When she advised him to go straight to a hospital, he laughed harshly. The skiff was wallowing so badly that one rogue wave could have swamped it. Nobody moved from their places as Stranahan motored tediously toward the western shoreline of Key Biscayne. The ride was wet and squirrely, but it smoothed out when they reached the Pines Canal. They dropped Tool off in some millionaire's backyard, walking distance from Crandon Boulevard. "Go take care of that bullet," Corbett said. Tool smiled ruefully, as if enjoying some private joke.
"I still don't understand what the hell you people wanted," he said. "What you hope to get from this whole fucked up deal?"
"Ask them," Corbett pointed to his sister and her accomplice.
"Accountability,"
Mick Stranahan said. "An ending," said Joey. "Maybe some peace of mind." Tool flapped his dripping arms in exasperation.
"But come on, life don't work like that."
"Oh, sometimes it does," Stranahan said. 30. Charles Perrone slept in his own bed, spooning the suitcase. He awoke before dawn, chewed up 5 cherry Maalox tablets, tossed a toothbrush and 3 pairs of clean underwear into a grocery bag, then sat down to write out a suicide note. "To all my friends and loved ones," he began without irony. "Life alone is unbearable. I am reminded of my precious Joey with every sunrise. Although I've tried to stay strong, I'm afraid it's impossible. I clung to hope as long as possible, but now it's time to face the awful truth. She is never coming back, and it's all my fault. How could I let her out of my sight that rainy night at sea? I pray that all of you can forgive me. I only wish I could forgive myself. Tonight I shall reunite with my beloved, so that we may embrace each other on our journey to a dear and better place. Get my swan costume ready. Yours in sorrow, Dr. Charles Perrone. Chaz foresaw that his integrity would be called into question once Joey surfaced and went to the police. It was his vainglorious hope that a heart-wrenching farewell message might cast enough doubt upon his wife's lurid story to gain him some getaway time. The salient phrases he had, of course, purloined from an internet site devoted to memorable suicide notes and famous last words. Chaz was especially fond of the final sentence, supposedly uttered in 1931 by ballerina Anna Pavlova as she exited the mortal stage. After taping the note to the refrigerator, he manually shredded the paper contents of his backpack. Special attention was given to the handwritten tables denoting minimal levels of phosphorus in the waste from Red Hammernut's farms. The dweebs at the water district would have been vexed to see that Chaz's charts had been completed and signed well in advance of upcoming sampling dates. Chaz had considered saving the forged documents in case he ever needed to blackmail Red or testify against him. Now, thanks to Chaz's $500,000 windfall, his most promising option was to disappear without a trace. He would miss his yellow Hummer, but only until he bought a new one. Assuming there was a dealership in Costa Rica. He was waiting on hold with the cab dispatcher when the doorbell rang. Quietly, he hung up the phone and padded to Tool's room, where he found a rusty revolver in a moldy gym bag. As he hurried back to the front of the house, the bell rang again. Chaz remained silent until the pounding started, as if someone was attacking the door with a croquet mallet.
"Yo! Knock it off! Who's there?"
"The cleaning lady."
"Rika?"
he said incredulously.
"Open up, or I'll scream bloody murder."
"Don't do that."
Her yowls could shatter crystal, as Chaz well remembered from their lovemaking.
Rika said,
"What do you think the cops are going to do with a guy who tries to rape a cripple?"
Chaz hastily wedged the handgun into his waistband and let her in. She glared as she clomped past him. The door was scuffed and dented where she had bludgeoned it with her cast.
"How's the leg?"
Chaz inquired tepidly.
"Fuck you."
"How'd you know I was home?"
"I tried calling all night long, and then it's 6 a.m. and your line's busy."
Rika skidding the plaster heel across the tile floor.
"I was on the computer." "Have a seat," Chaz said.
With an impatient sigh, she lowered herself onto the couch.
"I've been thinking about my new car. Forget the Mustang. I want a Thunderbird convertible instead."
"Sweet," said Chaz. The timing of her visit could not have been worse.
"P.S. Where's my money?"
"I'm working on it. Are you thirsty?"
"I don't suppose you've got whole milk," she said.
Chaz retreated to the kitchen and pretended to search the refrigerator, stalling while he improvised a new plan. When he stood up, Rika was there. How she'd crept up so stealthily with a bum leg, Chaz couldn't imagine, but her expression was one of toxic contempt. While he had been rooting leisurely through the beer and Mountain Dew, she'd been perusing his suicide note.
"Clever boy," she said. "You're making a run for it."
"What if I told you I was actually going to kill myself? I'm serious, honey. I've been super depressed."
"And you're packing a suitcase for the hereafter?"
She pointed to the gray Samsonite, which sat upright in the hall.
"Oh, that,"
Chaz said. "I can explain." She left him no choice but to kill her. Really kill her this time. He pulled out Tool's second gun.
"Not this again,"
Rika sighed. "Have you got a car?" Chaz had taken a taxi home from Miami. Since the Hummer was at the marina and the keys to the Hummer were in Tool's pocket and Tool was at the bottom of Biscayne Bay.
"Where are we going this time?"
Rika asked. Chaz herded her to the living room. He peeked through the shades and saw that she'd arrived in a generic white compact an Alamo plate on the front bumper. The trunk appeared adequate for the Samsonite and possibly a carry-on, but not in addition to a corpse with one leg and a bulky cast. No problem, Chaz told himself. I'll do it in the sticks somewhere, dump her body, then take her car to the airport. There was plenty of time. American had a 5 p.m. nonstop to San Jose.
Your fish are starved.
Rika peered with maternal concern at the aquarium.
Fuck 'em, Chaz said. Why was she reaching into the damn tank?
Looky here.
She held up a small platinum wedding band.
It was hanging from the mast of that little pirate ship.
Struggling to remain calm, Chaz ordered her to put the ring back in the water. She recited the inscription aloud.
To Joey, the girl of my dreams. Love, CRP. Oh, that's so romantic.
He indulged Rika her sarcasm. Perhaps she already knew that his missing wife was alive and well and determined to ruin his life, that the wedding band obviously had been placed in the aquarium to infuriate him. Perhaps they were even co-conspirators in the plot, Rika and Joey. Why not? Chaz thought. Nothing could shock him anymore. Rika was unable to fit the ring on the proper finger, so she slipped it on her pinky.
What do you think?
She cooed theatrically. Chaz resisted the urge to shoot her on the spot. Don't you move, he said, and for good measure swiped away the crutches and tossed them into the foyer.
Why was your wife's wedding ring in with the fishes?
She asked, wiggling the platinum-adorned pinky.
There must be a story.
Back in the kitchen, Chaz fitted the revolver into his battered left hand and hoped that Rika wouldn't try anything nutty this time. He winced at the memory of her ballsy dash for freedom at Loxahatchee. With his good hand, Chaz rolled the Samsonite toward the door, marveling at the cumbersome weight of wet cash. He shoved the crutches at Rika and snapped, "Come on, get your button gear."
"I dyed my pubes green for you, and this is the thanks I get?"
It was unnerving that she could crack jokes, that she wasn't shaking in fear and begging for her life. "Let's go for a ride," he said.
"How dumb do you think I am?"
"We can debate that later."
"I'm not going any place with you, Thimble Dick."
All that prevented him from shooting her was knowing that a woman's bloodstains on his wall would vastly complicate the suicidal widower scenario that he had so artfully crafted. He'd invested too much effort in his farewell note to discard it. "Get up, Rika. Now."
"Nope. You'll have to carry me."
Wouldn't it be a treat, Chaz thought, to have just one goddamn day when nobody fucked with my head? Outside, a car horn honked three times. Rika smiled.
"What now?"
Chaz groused to himself.
"Listen, I wasn't serious about the Thunderbird," she confessed, "or the 250 grand.
"Then I don't understand."
"Of course you don't," she said.
The door burst open, and there loomed Earl Edward O'Toole, his broad chest cross-hatched with white tape. In a voice as dry as ashes, Charles Perrone said,
"You have got to be shitting me."
First Joey, then Rika, now the goon. How can it be so hard to kill somebody, Chaz wondered. With an incensed squawk, he leveled the gun, his bruised and misshapen index finger picking impotently at the trigger. Toole casually clocked him with a left hook to the jaw. 12 hours later, the Humvee rumbled down the L-39 levee, Faith Hill singing sweetly on the radio, Red Hammernut mouthing an ivory toothpick while meticulously unspooling the video cassette he had removed from Chaz's VCR.
"Here's what I don't get,"
Red was saying to Toole.
"How come that Rika girl knew to call me? I'm damn glad she did and all, but it's strange how she'd come to have my name and phone number."
Toole, who was driving, said he had no earthly idea.
"You ask her?"
"She said some fella wrote it on a prayer card and gave it to her at Joey Perrone's church service. Whether that's true or not, I guess it don't matter now."
Red Hammernut pocketed the toothpick and hawked out the window.
This old deal has been a royal goat fuck from start to finish. I damn near lost track of which way's up and which way's down.
Toole could have enlightened Red about the doctor's botched attempt to murder not only Rika Spillman, but Mrs. Perrone, but he didn't feel much like chatting. Every rut in the levee reminded him of the fresh slug in his armpit. The discomfort was amplified by his sobriety, Toole having given his last fentanyl patch to Maureen. From the corner of his eye, he saw the tangled remains of the Sun Duchess videotape fly out of the Hummer, Red saying he couldn't afford to have that nosy damn detective get hold of it. Earlier at the office, Red had destroyed his own copy. He said,
"I still can't believe that yuppie cocksucker shot you point blank. We had such a good plan, too."
Not entirely, thought Toole. Red had ordered him to kill Chaz Perrone before they got to Stiltsville, but Toole had privately scotched the idea. He'd been doing a lot of heavy thinking over what Maureen had said about making changes, that you were never too old to pick a positive new direction for your life. Toole knew that if he whacked the doctor, he'd end up blabbing to Maureen, and he couldn't bear the thought of upsetting her when she was feeling so poorly. So he'd decided that instead of murdering Perrone, he would simply heave him off the boat and make him swim to shore. Warn him to never again show his skeeter-bitten puss in Florida. But the fucker shot him first. As for the blackmail meeting, it had been Toole's intention and Red's firm instruction to deliver the money peaceably. When Toole had expressed surprise that Red was willing to kiss off 500 grand, Red laughed so hard that a string of snot had shot out of his nose. He told Toole about a James Bond-type gizmo that he'd found at a Cuban spy shop in Miami. A transmitter, Red had explained, no bigger than a pack of Winstons. Toole had tucked it into the Samsonite when he was loading the cash. Meantime, Red was lining up some heavyweight shit-kickers to track the suitcase back on the mainland, to take care of the blackmailer, the mystery girlfriend, whoever else was in on the scam. But Charles Perrone stole the money first. Afterward, when Chaz ditched the boat and waded to shore, the Samsonite must have sprung a leak and the transmitter shorted out. Toole had listened to Red pitch a conniption about the money going missing, but then the phone rang, the woman named Rika on the other end saying,
"Chaz Perrone's back in Boca, if you're interested."
Red, telling her to wait for him to get there, slamming down the phone and saying to Toole,
"Let's get a move on. The dumbass went straight home."
Now the suitcase was stowed safely in the back of the Humvee, along with Charles Perrone, who was headed to the Everglades for the very last time.
"See? It's all working out,"
Red Hammernut said. Except that Toole still didn't have much appetite for killing Perrone, even though the man had shot him and left him for dead in Stiltsville. It was the strangest sensation. All day long, Toole had worried about how to get out of the chore, since Red was coming along to make sure it got done right.
"I sure like this Faith Hill gal," Red was saying. "Know who else? That Shania Twain."
"Yeah, me too.
I read where she might be related to the writer fella Twain, the one wrote that famous Huckleberry book."
"Is that right?"
"About this smarty-pants white kid and a big nigger fella, and they's on a raft together down some river?"
"Okay."
Toole assumed that Red Hammernut had been drinking.
"Shania, see, she's like Mark Twain's great-great-great-grandniece. That's what the article said, anyhow."
"Maybe she could do her next video on a raft," said Toole, playing along. "Her and the band."
"Son, that girl could do a video in a jiffy, John, and make it look like the Taj Mahal."
Red turned to peer in the back of the Hummer.
"Hey, our friend finally got quiet."
They'd hogtied the biologist, hauled him back to LaBelle, and stashed him in a refrigerator truck with 1,700 pounds of fresh-picked cabbage and celery. Toole had driven himself home to get some clean overalls and irrigate the grassy field where his highway crosses were planted, while Red Hammernut had spent the afternoon entertaining two state senators who'd come up with a promising scheme to subvert the NAFTA treaty and fuck over the tomato growers in Mexico. Later, when everybody else was gone, Toole and Red had come back to remove Chaz Perrone, blue-lipped and shivering, from the frigid truck. Then, utilizing the latest vegetable-packing technology, they had shrink-wrapped him from head to toe.
He was expected to expire from asphyxiation before they arrived at the Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge. That was where Red had chosen to get rid of the body, a comfortable distance from Hammernut Farms.
"Guess I'll have to find me another so-called scientist who loves money more than sawgrass and mudfish," Red was saying. "Otherwise, Uncle Sam's going to make me dig some goddamn filtration pond to clean up my water. We're talking millions of dollars, not counting the lawyers and politicians I gotta pay. And they wonder how come the American farmer is a dying breed."
Looking at Red's buffed fingernails and bleached teeth, Tool wondered when was the last time he'd touched a shovel or a hoe. It was a known fact that Red's late daddy had made a killing off natural gas in Arkansas, and that Red had used his inheritance to buy up row crop operations all over the Sun Belt.
"Hi. There's the truck," Red said.
Tool braked to a halt next to a dusty Dodge pickup. It had been parked on the levee an hour earlier by one of Red's trusted crew bosses, so that Red and Tool would have transportation out of the Loxahatchee Preserve. They intended to abandon the Hummer at the edge of the Rim Canal, Chaz Perrone's suicide message attached to the dashboard. Red said the note was a bonus, though he wasn't sure what to make of the part about the swan getup. Dragging their captive out of the Hummer, they were surprised to find that he wasn't dead. With the tenacity of a psychotic gopher, Chaz had gnawed a ragged hole in the shrink wrap through which he now labored to breathe. It sounded like molasses being sucked down a drainpipe.
"Damnation," Red said.
He snatched a Remington 12-gauge off the back seat and ordered Tool to cut the sumbitch loose.
"You sure?"
"Hell yes."
Tool used a pocket knife to skin off the plastic cocoon. Chaz levered himself to a squat, his clothes sopping and his face flushed.
"Thank you,"
he wheezed. Red Hammernut said,
"What the hell for? We're still going to wax your thieving ass."
"Red, I'm so truly sorry about the money."
"I don't doubt it."
"I'll do whatever you want. Just tell me."
The doctor cowered there, shrunken and hollow-eyed, a squalid portrait of guilt. While Tool had no sympathy, neither was he in the mood to watch a man's brains get splattered like oatmeal. Red said,
"It was a setup from day one, right? There wasn't no damn blackmail, just you and some greedy asshole pals."
"That's not true," Chaz protested.
"I always figured you killed your wife. That much I put together from the get-go," Red said. "But for you to video the whole thing, that's some sick shit. Just to squeeze some cash out of me? Son, you are one evil little bastard."
"Listen, Red, I did not kill Joey. She's alive."
Red glanced over at Tool, who shrugged blankly.
"Hey, then what you're saying, she must be in on this too."
"Exactly," Chaz exclaimed. "She's the one behind the blackmail."
"Your dead wife?"
"Yes, I found out last night."
Red nodded.
"Well, son, you just answered my next question. What's that? How low can you go?"
"Oh, Red, I'm telling the God's truth.
Let's get Mr. O'Toole's opinion."
Tool was watching the sun go down, thinking about the hot, throbbing knot under his arm.
"Give me the shotgun," he said.
Red grinned in relief.
"That's my boy."
In the distance, a bull alligator grunted. Tool took the Remington and slotted a shell into the chamber. He told Chaz Perrone to stand up and turn around. Slowly, Red Hammernut backed away, saying,
"I believe I'll wait in the truck."
"Sure," Tool thought. "Wouldn't want no blood on your fancy catalog clothes." "Get in the water," Tool said to Chaz.
"Tell him I'm not lying about Joey, please."
"You kept me and swiped the money."
"Yes, I made a horrible mistake. Yes," Chaz said breathlessly.
"You sure did. Now, I'm gonna count to five."
"Oh, God, don't make me go into that water."
"That's what you did to your girlfriend, right? What's to be scared of?"
Another big gator huffed. Somewhere off in a slough.
"Mating season," Tool surmised.
Chaz began quivering uncontrollably. He slapped his hands on his thighs and said, "Look at me! Just look!" It was a sorry damn sight, Toole had to admit. The man was wearing an undershirt, plaid boxers, and shiny brown socks. That's how they'd hauled him out of his house. The skeeters were feasting on his soft arms and knobby broomstick legs.
"Want some free advice?" Toole said.
"Okay, sure."
The doctor nodded stiffly.
"Run like hell."
"Where? Out there?"
He motioned wildly behind him.
"Yep," Toole said. "Here goes. 1, 2, 3.
Chaz Perone lurched down the embankment and crashed into the knee-deep swamp, a setting most unfavorable for an Olympic-style sprint. He fled from the levee in an exaggerated lead-footed swagger, splashing with crazed desperation through the heavy grass. Toole's first shot went too far left. His second shot was low, kicking up a small geyser that soaked the droopy rump of Chaz's underpants. The third shot was wide right. Red Hammernut hopped out of a pickup, bellowing angrily. Toole squinted through one eye, pretending to concentrate. At the fourth shot, Chaz let out a cry and toppled over.
"Finally,"
Red declared, only to watch the biologist rise up and resume his sloppy escape, pushing a crooked liquid trail through the sawgrass prairie. Red seized the Remington from Toole and feverishly took aim.
"Hurry," Toole said with a hint of a smile, which Red failed to notice.
"You shut up."
Red's shot, the last shell in the gun, flew so high off the mark that the buckshot sprinkled down in a loose crescent, as harmless as pebbles, well behind the departing target.
"God damn!"
Red jumped off the ground in frustration.
"Go get him! Go on!"
Toole laconically declined.
"My arm hurts from where that fucker shot me,"
reminding Red of his recent sacrifice in the line of duty.
"But Christ almighty, he's getting away!"
"Then you go after him, Chief," Toole suggested. "Let me bright the headlights so you can see him better."
One of the lovesick gators grunted, this time closer. Red Hammernut did not advance even a millimeter toward the still, dark water.
"Well, God damn," he said,
studying the shotgun in his hands as if it had malfunctioned supernaturally.
"I'm empty."
"Yep," Toole said.
In a taut and flurried silence, the two of them watched Charles Regis Perone, Ph.D., vanish gradually into the rich copper twilight of the swamp. 31. Joey Perone burrowed into the folds of her brother's sheepskin coat. "Can't you stay a few more days?" "Romance and adventure beckon," Corbett Wheeler said.